Once anyone has grasped the concept or root understanding, things start to make sense. Aliens are seen walking through walls or floating in thin air, ships are seen appearing and disappearing. It's not magic, demons or angels. It's just advanced technology. Alien healings. What do aliens really want from us? I have a pretty good idea, and I say more about that in the next chapter. At this time I will discuss another pattern that helped me to discover Hathi's 186, what I have learned creatures are up to. They have invested a great deal of time and effort in us abductees, even to the point of periodically maintaining our health. I am not suggesting, by any means, that they take care of every little ailment or sickness, or all life-threatening diseases. I am not exactly sure what motivates them to intercede in an abductee's health. I personally know for a fact, however, that from time to time they either adjust or correct abductees' ailments, for it has happened to me on several occasions, see the gift on page 146, and to other abductees whom I know. Let me tell you about the doctor. In late 1995, I contracted a terrible flu with weakness, coughing, fever, chills, and nausea. I felt like hell. I don't get sick often, and when I do, it's short-lived. This illness was different, however. It dragged on for a month, and I was not getting better. Then, one evening, I had an unconventional doctor's visit. I was asleep on my sofa, when I suddenly woke up paralyzed, except for my eyes. I was turned sideways, facing my living room's front wall, through which walked two aliens. I remember thinking, "Here we go again." I was more angry than scared. I telepathed to them, "Why am I paralyzed? I thought I was past all this junk. Besides, I am real sick, and I am in no mood for this." As if my mood would make a difference, they walked toward me, and the nearest alien manifested a screen image over his face, an image of a close doctor friend of mine whom I will call Dr. T, who treated me for several years after a terrible car accident. I had grown to love and deeply respect this man, whose wonderful bedside manner is a real pleasure to experience. I am sure that the aliens were aware of my fondness for this doctor, from their probing of my memories. They also knew that this created image would make me feel less apprehensive. They were right. I didn't fight the false reality of that particular alien appearing as Dr. T. As he approached me, I asked, "What are you doing here?" He responded, "Don't you remember? I am here because of our agreement." 187. "The keepers to what?" I asked. "You remember," he said, "we agreed that if ever you were to get real sick, I would come." His face looked very friendly. Even though I knew that he was not Dr. T, I felt happy imagining that he was. Suddenly, I remembered our agreement. "Yes, I remember now. Whenever I get real sick, you said that you would come. And now you are here." "That's right, and now I am going to examine you." They both leaned forward and proceeded to do just that, examine me. They took several minutes poking, prodding, and turning me around in different directions. I felt an assortment of instruments making contact all around various parts of my body. When they were finished, they stepped back, and the one who looked like Dr. T said, "You have a secondary upper lung and throat infection as a result of the flu." I said, "Well, did you hear me?" I got no response, so asked again, "Did you hear me?" Again no response, so I said, "Should I go see a regular doctor, or what?" They never responded, but simply turned and walked back out through the same wall through which they had come. A few seconds later, I passed out. When I opened my eyes, it was morning. I sat up on the sofa and stretched my arms. I suddenly realized that I was not sick anymore. While I resist believing that the aliens would do something as helpful as healing, I cannot argue the fact that I was miraculously healed. Black helicopters. During their visits, aliens seem to frequently create interdimensional fields that alter matter for travel, duplication, invisibility, and passing through solid objects. I am sure that these fields have countless other uses that we have not yet observed. In my experience, a special traceable signature or residue lingers. 188. What I have learned during and after the use of one of these interdimensional fields. This signature is unique and is clearly distinguishable from anything else, using appropriate monitoring devices. Without doubt, it's the most dependable way covert government agencies can monitor alien activity. This residue can linger for quite some time on anything, including humans, with which it comes in contact. It is my belief that there is not a single abduction, cattle mutilation, or other alien-related event that takes place without the knowledge of certain government agencies that monitor these activities. If this signature is particularly strong, it indicates frequent or extended activity. In that event, black unmarked helicopters are dispatched to check it out. Not every event warrants an investigation. I have noticed that usually several events take place before a helicopter is dispatched to inspect more closely. I understand to a certain degree why ominous black helicopters show up from time to time. A high percentage of abductees claim to have seen these black metallic birds. Usually it's after an abduction or sighting. Sometimes it's after cattle mutilations or the appearance of spectacular crop circles. I feel certain that I know one of the reasons that they appear, and I have a good idea who pilots them. And it's not aliens. In my July 1995 encounter with the Doctor, the aliens worked with me, in our dimension, for the entire evening. They conducted what I believed to be experiments and medical procedures. Because this session was of such long duration, the lingering effects of the field were very strong. After the aliens left, I felt as if I had been irradiated. My senses were extremely sensitized, and my developing sixth sense was especially sharp and clear. I felt magnetic. The residual effect of being exposed to their field was extremely strong. I am no longer traumatized by alien visitations. In fact, I was enjoying the doctor's visit, and I tried to take advantage of its strong residual effect as long as possible. I knew that it wouldn't last very long. 189. The keepers. I had made a commitment a few days earlier to take my 7-year-old niece to school on the morning that unexpectedly featured the doctor. I also had some items to pick up at the Kmart, which was near the school. After dropping off my niece, I arrived at Kmart 30 minutes before opening time, so I waited in my car, which was the only customer vehicle in the lot. As I waited, I felt a strange sensation course through my body, the same feeling I had felt a few months earlier just before the diamond-shaped ship appeared in broad daylight on the beach, see Diamond in the Sky on page 160. I exited the car, knowing somehow to look north. It was clear, and at first I saw nothing, but I knew I would, because the residual effect was very strong and all of my six senses were extra keen. Then it appeared, a black dot that gradually grew larger, until it became recognizable as a black helicopter. It emitted a deep, thundering roar as it made a beeline in my direction. I have on other occasions seen silent black helicopters. I had no doubt that it was looking for me. I felt it. It approached fast and suddenly stopped, hovering over me and my car. It seemed to be hovering at about 150 feet in the air, and its color was pitch black. The windows were opaque black, and I could see no occupants. I stood staring at it for 20 or 25 seconds. I made a few very noticeable obscene gestures, as many as I could think to create. Finally, the aircraft slowly looped around and headed back in the direction from which it had come. I was radiating a strong residual signature that morning. I feel certain to this day that the reason for this close encounter with this black helicopter was my residual signature from my experience with the doctor. Died 6 months before the doctor healed my flu, I had had another medical visit that was very uncomfortable. It changed my eating habits in a very profound way. I had been a heavy meat eater. My diet included a rare steak at least once a week. 190. What I have learned: hamburgers for lunch at least twice a week, meatloaf, pot roasts, pork ribs, roast pork, you name it. I was a true carnivore. But not anymore. Since this event, my diet has consisted of the minimal amount of chicken and fish, some bread, and of course, vegetables. Anyone who knows me knows that this change in my diet is not like me at all. It would take an act of Congress for Jim to stop eating meat, people would say. But I did stop, and I'll share the reason. Some of these alien medical exams, unfortunately, include anal probes. Yuck. A subject I do not enjoy talking about, writing about, or experiencing. Of course, not everything I write about is comfortable to relive, and in this case I feel it is necessary. I was asleep on my sofa when I was escorted to the ET craft the easy way, and I found myself face down on an examination table, in tremendous pain. They had inserted a deep anal probe into me, and I could feel it churning about in my guts. I felt so miserable that I cried out, "What the hell are you doing to me?" One of them responded, "An examination of your system. The pain is awful. You're hurting me," I yelled. Then I blacked out. When I regained consciousness, I found myself face up on the table, sore inside, but not in pain. Two aliens were present, and it appeared that they were just finishing up their procedure. One of them said telepathically, "It is necessary that you stop eating animals. Your system is overloaded with trash." The word trash surprised me. Intelligence dictates that you do not have to kill to survive. I blacked out again, and later I found myself at home. When I sat up, my insides were extremely sore. I was accustomed to a little discomfort from my encounters with these creatures, and I knew any discomfort caused by them would pass relatively fast. I went into the kitchen, made some coffee, and started making breakfast. As I opened the refrigerator door to reach for the bacon, these words rang through my head, "U-191, the keepers must stop eating animals." I could not bring myself to cook the bacon. At lunch I stopped for a fast food burger, but I couldn't eat it. This pattern continues to this very day. I can no longer eat red meat. I like the change in my diet, and I feel better. Exactly 30 days after this diet-changing visit, the aliens returned and I suddenly awoke to see them walking through my wall again. I had thought that they would be working with me again in my living room. As they approached, I passed out and found myself on my side on the examination table. They were poking and prodding me again and I hated it. "Damn it," I said, "why are you doing this again?" I stopped eating meat. "We know," they said, "we had to make sure that it was helping you, and it is." I blacked out, and when I regained consciousness, I found myself at home again. My insides were sore for a few days, however, but I have not eaten red meat since that time. I have done many speaking engagements across the country, and I have met many fellow abductees. The bulk of them are vegetarians. I find that odd. Do you? Hybrids. The alien-human hybrid life form is neither a created worker, nor a human, nor an alien, but a combination of human and alien. It is part of the alien's insurance policy. They are creating a being that is more alien than human, at least more alien than we are. This way, if we fail to turn our environment around and we die off, after the dust settles, they can repopulate the Earth with hybrids that could possibly be more adaptable to the Earth's changed environment. They need far less food, water and energy, yet they still have enough human raw material to be useful to the aliens. What I have learned, walk-ins, we come in many different shapes and sizes. To me, a walk-in is an alien who appears in a human form and contacts abductees on our turf. In my experience, there are two types. A type 1 alien walk-in screen images himself to look human. He is physically alien, but he simply projects a human image. A perfect example of this type is described in Chapter 10, "The Boss Wants to See You," on page 85. The type 2 walk-in looks human in every way. This type is extremely perplexing. I have great difficulty accepting that they exist, however, I know from personal experience they do, which can also be verified through other abductees. Other abductees and I have experienced these beings completely alone, and in a few cases with other abductees. Type 2 walk-ins pop in on us from time to time and talk in riddles. They may start a conversation with you out of the blue and speak on a topic you shared with someone else in private. They exhibit the same behavioral patterns as alien doctors, appearing only when really needed. I am very uncomfortable with Type 2s because it is hard enough to deal with aliens on board their craft, without having to interact with them in my own space. Also, I feel safer not relating too many stories regarding my face-to-face contact with what I call walk-ins because I'm not sure what my involvement is with them or how much information I should reveal. I believe there aren't very many of them, and their appearance is rare. I don't believe the men who followed me around in Texas were aliens. I think, however, they were government people. In what capacity? Who knows? Bud Hopkins theorizes that they were human all right, but possibly born and raised by aliens. Here is a personal example of the type 2 walk-in that involves another abductee and me. My close friend Don, his daughter, her fiancé and I had rented a van and drove 600 miles from South Florida to Mobile, Alabama, for a UFO conference. 193, 192. The keepers on the way over we talked about everything under the sun to occupy 12 hours of driving time. At one point we talked about recent movies, in particular, City Slickers. For hours none of us could come up with the name of a popular actor in this movie. We struggled and strained our brains to the point of exhaustion, and at times it was at the tip of our tongues, but none of us could come up with his name. Finally we gave up. About 10 minutes later, out of a dead silence, Don's daughter and her fiancé simultaneously shouted, "Jack Palance." We all laughed. "Stay with me, and it will start to make sense." The day after arriving in Mobile, Don and I walked around the downtown area looking for a place to eat lunch. We paused for a moment across the street from a few restaurants, talking among ourselves and deciding where to eat. As we stood there, an odd middle-aged man in house painting clothes walked up and said, "Come on in, because in here, you can have anything you could possibly want." It was an innocent enough statement, nothing really out of the ordinary, except for some oddities. He didn't come from inside the restaurant, he came from down the street. It wasn't as if he had just eaten there, and was walking out complimenting the place. Also, after making that statement, he didn't go into the restaurant. Further, we had been across the street from the restaurant, talking alone, completely out of earshot of anyone. We could have been discussing anything, not necessarily restaurants. The events so far really didn't get my attention until later, but they piqued Don's attention. He commented, "How odd." We looked at each other, shrugged our shoulders, walked across the street and ate. As we were sitting at the table, our friend, whom Don and I now fondly refer to as the painter, walked up to our table from what seemed like out of nowhere. He looked at Don and said, "Do you know who you look like? It's on the tip of my tongue, give me a second, He continued to act in this manner, repeating the same words over again. Don and I looked at each other with a strange smile. 194, what I have learned as he rambled on. Suddenly he shouted with emotion, "I got it now. You look like that actor, Jack Palance." Being in law enforcement and thinking like an investigator, Don processed the facts of the case. He quoted and expressed our conversation in the van, word for word. How can anybody do that? Unless the van was bugged. However, we rented this van out of the blue, no one had any real time to prepare. First he said, "Come on in. You can have anything you want," and remembering a conversation word for word the way he did. "Jim, I think this man is a walk-in." At the time I didn't agree or disagree with Don's conclusion. After lunch, we went back to the hotel and attended the conference. The idea that this man was possibly a walk-in did briefly run through my mind, but I dismissed it. Early that evening after the conference was finished for the day, I met a young abductee woman who was very nervous about her experiences. I felt led to help her cope with some advice. Although there was a lot she wanted to say, she was hesitant to speak, primarily because of not wanting to be overheard by any of her conference attending friends. I assured her there would be no pressure from me, and perhaps we could find some out-of-the-way place to talk, where none of her friends could possibly run into us, and she agreed. We searched and found what we thought was the perfect spot, an old-fashioned bar and grill. After a few minutes of talking, someone tapped me on the back. I turned and was shocked to see our friend, the painter. Before I could say anything, he looked me in the eye and said, "You should know, we come in many shapes and sizes." He turned and walked out. I sat there with my mouth open and watched him walk away. The young woman said, "Wow, it felt strange when he was standing next to us. Who was he?" "Oh, he's a painter, just simply a painter," I replied. She sensed I didn't want to talk about it and didn't ask any more questions. Later that evening I caught up with Don and told him the story. It helped to confirm what Don believed. I still wasn't sure. However, it was strange. 195. The Keeper's Sunday afternoon rolled along, and the conference was winding down. Don found me in the lobby and said, "I ran into our friend again, or should I say he ran into me?" I asked Don, "Well, what did he say?" "He walked up to me," Don said, offered his hand and we shook. He was wearing old shabby painter's clothes, so I asked him if he was attending the conference. He said no. Although I knew he wasn't with the conference, I asked him in order to dig for information. I asked him if he was doing some work here, like painting, etc. He answered in a riddle, "No, I am not working here, but I have a few loose ends to tie up here, and then my work here will be finished." Then he left. Don continued, "The point here is this, he obviously knew of our conversation in the van. He knew what we were talking about on the street that day, and there wasn't anyone around to overhear our conversation. He shows up in that out-of-the-way place where you were the other night. Then he tells you, we come in many different shapes and sizes. Then he shows up at a UFO conference in shabby clothes and talks in riddles by saying he is not here to attend the conference or do any work. However, he still had some loose ends to tie up and his work is finished. Jim, he must be a walk-in." Whether or not this man was truly a walk-in is unprovable. Don seemed convinced. As far as I was concerned, there were many odd indications pointing in that direction, and this will have to be enough for you to get the picture of what a walk-in is. I will close this chapter with an example statement made to me by a person who made it clear he was a walk-in. These people are intergalactic or interdimensional travelers. The following statement typifies that fact. At one point in a conversation with one of these fellows, I asked, "How long will you be here?" He said, "I will be here for 2 weeks, but I am leaving tomorrow." Chapter 23. The real situation. In some ways, this chapter was the most difficult to write because of the complexity of the phenomena. On the other hand, the passing of much of the pain associated with the subject makes it easier now. My life and the way I view things have been tremendously expanded. The knowledge and understanding I have gained are beyond compare. Although I feel that I have paid a very high price, anything worthwhile has its price. This is a law that I feel applies to the whole universe. We are not alone in the universe, we play a major role in the universal life chain. Yet I feel that there is another universal law: higher intelligence takes advantage of and uses lower intelligence, not unlike the way we use cattle. With the privilege of use comes the responsibility of care. A farmer tends to his animals by feeding them and taking care of their medical needs. He makes sure that all their survival needs are met so that he and his family can also survive. The cow, with its limited intelligence, lives out its lifespan completely unaware of its fate. If, however, the pasture were to become contaminated, the farmer would take actions to protect his investment, either by cleaning the pasture or moving the cattle. If he had the technology, he might even take eggs and sperm from the herd and store them as insurance against the possibility that the pasture could not be saved, or that the cattle would be unsalvageable. Clearly, it would be easier to move cattle seeds than cattle bod. 196, 197. The keeper's eye to cleaner pastures, and any such activity would take place right under the cattle's noses, without an inkling that anything was out of the ordinary. Of course, humans are not cattle, and the earth is not a green pasture. Or is it? The earth is too big to be a pasture, and humans are too intelligent to be cattle. Or are they? We know we are too smart to destroy our environment. Or are we? Our governments and scientists tell us that we are effectively alone in the universe, and we believe what they say. Or do we? Why do aliens take seed and raw materials from humans? One revelation that came to me is that the aliens are creating worker beings, much as ants do. Does this mean that the aliens are farming us? Yes, it does, but not to eat, fortunately. Farming humans for raw materials and spare parts is only part of the story. The field, the alien field to which I have frequently referred, may be electromagnetic, vibrational, or something for which we have no name. Light is sometimes associated with it. I have been exposed to it many times, and it makes my body feel magnetic. At times I feel static electricity. At other times everything it influences loses color and fades into black and white. This field enables the aliens to do many marvelous things, some of which I discuss below. Invisibility. When the man in the dark suit escorted me from my house to the beach, you may recall that when we got to the water's edge, we stood there waiting, watching an obscure small light hanging not far away over the water. Suddenly the light formed into a large rectangle into which we stepped, and we were on board one of their spacecraft. The ship had been there all along, but it used the field to make itself invisible. Interdimensional travel. Interdimensional travel is the ability to go from point A to point B in literally no time at all. I know this, because I have been taken by this field from my home to 198, the real situation, and from their ships and to different points on the Earth's surface. The Star People use this field both to travel across galaxies and to transport selected people to and from their ships any time they wish. Distance becomes inconsequential, and our laws of science are probably a minor and incomplete subset of their science laws. Screen images. The field seems to play at least a part in screen imaging. You might recall that once when I was out driving, I thought I saw a flock of birds, when in reality it was three ships in formation. It seems that they use the field to disguise themselves and to project perceptions that people see. Scanning. The field seems to enable the aliens to scan us and to know ourselves better than we do. With it they can browse through every minute detail of our lives, including lost memories. Technology. The aliens use thought-activated technology, and their machines are at least partially biological and can interact with us as if they were alive. Their ability to take in, process and project information is so vast that they can see the future coming. Spare parts. With all that they can do, why do the aliens need us? What is the common denominator that links all intelligent life? It is the need to survive as long as possible. I suspect that if intelligent life could live forever, it would. I further believe that our alien friends come very close to immortality, but they need us to do it. I have seen and experienced many, many things to reach this conclusion. Natural life dictates the inescapable need to survive for as long as possible. It is as natural for animals and humans as for aliens. We all seek all means to feed the yearning appetite that survival demands. An animal seeks food and shelter, knowing that if it gets too cold or doesn't eat, it will die, but its brain 199, the keeper's capacity, limits it to hunting for food and shelter. Humans, with larger brains, have developed medicine and science and can even transplant spare body parts, if the tissue match is compatible. What if we could successfully implant into animals significant portions of our genetic code, not enough to interfere with the animal's well-being, but enough to maintain a sustainable reservoir of human DNA, blood and tissue, to support human bodily repair needs? There would be medical teams to track, secure, tag and extract necessary materials. Individual animals and bloodlines would have to be tracked constantly, so that they could be retrieved on demand. You get the picture. Aliens have been taking advantage of us with their superior technology in secret for a very long time. They implanted portions of their genetic code in humans long, long ago, and their ships come regularly, in waves, to abduct, secure, and return tens of thousands of humans, extracting whatever biological materials they need. The donor is unharmed and completely unaware that anything is missing. The tiny wound is quickly healed by the abductee, donor. However, they transplant in ways we do not understand. With their field technology, they can reduce extracted biological specimens to vapor and then superimpose it into the recipient, where the pattern is reproduced as necessary. See figure X. Consider, the Earth and the known universe are billions of years old, life is abundant in the universe, and countless intelligent cultures have developed, advanced, and died out. Flying discs have been seen and recorded throughout human history, from cave drawings to today's video recordings. Every year, thousands of people around the world report being abducted, many of whom report extraction of semen or eggs.